It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're going to be talking about Ryan Braun for the next few minutes, and we're going to be looking for your calls, your comments as well. It's been about a month since Ryan Braun acknowledged that he made some mistakes. And yesterday, Ryan Braun finally released a statement of apology and guilt. He's followed it up with an email to his fans.
Was it enough? What do you think, Milwaukee? What do you think, Wisconsin? Will you forgive Ryan Braun? Are you ready? Is it too soon? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or send us an email to talk@wpr.org.
There have already been, of course, a lot of reactions to that apology. Some of those reactions have not been very supportive. Some of the reactions, though, there was a reporter, I think, on ESPN or Major League Baseball who said it sounded very contrite. So where do you fall on this? The apology is pretty long, but if you read it very closely, some of it would say that his admission of guilt was a little light on the details. So, for example, if you look through that whole document that he put out, you never see the words performance-enhancing drugs. You never see the words steroids in the apology. And at one point, he kind of suggests that he used creams and lozenges in a real temporary way to support an injury.
Well, what do you think? Should we forgive Ryan Braun? We will go right to your calls. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And of course, Ryan Braun, a favorite son in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Brewers. He was a big star of the team. His fall from grace was big in Milwaukee and beyond, of course, throughout Wisconsin. He's got this apology out there now. Are we ready to hear it? Are we ready to listen? And, America seems to like a comeback. That could be the beginning of what this is now. But it all depends on the fans' response. What do you think? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page or at 1-800-642-1234.
And speaking of which, we already have a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Kara on Facebook writes, "How are these words to be believed when he lied before? He probably had the PR firm write it anyway, just words." So that's what Kara thinks. And she's referring back, I think, to that initial investigation back in 2011 when he said, "It wasn't me. It was a bad test. And my trainer, I think, gave him the wrong urine sample or something like that." And it's gotten awfully sticky. So let's go to the phones right now. We've got some people who would like to weigh in. And we begin with Mike, who joins us from Superior. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Okay, what do you think?
My comment is, if they should either ban him completely or let everybody use drugs, have a level playing field out there. It's not fair for a pitcher who does not take drugs to throw to batters that do, or pitchers that take drugs to throw to batters that don't. Look at, they had a deal about Wally Joyner. He had in his contract, if he made the All-Star team, that he would get a $50,000 bonus. He didn't make it because Mark McGwire did. He was all juiced up. That's not fair to the players that aren't using it. My comment is either let them all use it or ban anybody that uses drugs.
So we're kind of keeping an informal...
Ryan Braun knows that.
So I'm keeping an informal poll here, and it sounds like you're not buying his apology.
No, I don't... No, because... He got out of it on the first one. Why didn't he come clean right away?
He had that opportunity 2 years ago.
Right. That's right. You work for a company that's drug-free, and you get caught, you're gone.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for the call, and we appreciate your comments. And Mike's taken a pretty hard line, and it'll be interesting to see what others of you around Wisconsin think. Don't forget, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We'd like to find out where you fall on the whole Ryan Braun apology. We've heard from him yesterday. He says in that apology, by the way, that he is aware that my admission may result in additional attacks and accusations from others. Is that fair? Do you think that is deserved?
He He's also said, you know, he feels bad about how this has affected his teammates and that they've been put in some pretty difficult situations. You know, you kind of wonder what they're thinking at this moment right now, too, if they're how they're taking this apology from Ryan Braun. Let's go to Dave in Hillsboro. Dave, you're next. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Instead of my comment is instead of apologizing to the fans of the Brewers, I think that Ryan Braun should actually apologize to the individual who handled his drug sample 2 years ago. And because Ryan Braun decided to say that that his sample was mishandled or you know the chain of command was not followed correctly, that guy lost his job. And I think Ryan Braun should apologize to the guy who handled the sample and basically ruined his life.
That's an interesting point, Dave. Yeah, you wonder if there has been some sort of outreach from Ryan Braun personally that was not public there. So, Dave, for your poll, Gene not buying the apology.
It's 2-0 right now. We'll see how forgiving the people of Wisconsin are.
All right, let's go next to Mark in Madison. Hey, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing all right. As far as the drug thing goes, I think, number one, he should apologize to everybody involved, especially the fans. And number two, he should also be banned for life from playing any kind of a sport because these players are the players that the kids look up to and they want to be like. So if it's okay for the players to do drugs, then it's okay for the kids to do drugs, and we wonder why there's a big drug problem.
Do you think, Mark, though, that in a way you could argue he set a good example? He messed up. Kids mess up. He apologized. That's a good lesson for kids. You screw up, you have to take it on the chin.
And that's the bottom line. You know, and if you start kicking the players out that are doing drugs, then the drug problem should fall because players want to play. And it's either do drugs and don't play, or you don't do drugs and you do play.
So a ban for life, I think, is what Mark is advocating for. One strike, you're out on that. Yeah.
One strike.
Yes, I am.
All right. Mark, thanks so much for the call. Let's go on to Appleton now, and Luke joins us. Hi, Luke.
Well, hello. My analysis would be that I think he could have restored hero worship, and that's what professional sportsmanship is. You see, they have I don't know what to say, the guts. I mean, a lot of us don't have guts or courage, but if he'd had the guts to actually go before the cameras, there would have been like a famous politician, there would have been cameras and action, lights. I mean, that would have restored the hero worship. No, he's got to issue a press release. And then the local news, they try to report it like, oh, like as if there's a big difference between appearing in person where you can see the visual reactions, you got the verbal reactions and all that, but what, a press release from the AP or who, it doesn't matter, the wire photos, it doesn't make any difference. That's what really bothers me. The rest, I've heard the calls, yeah, I agree somewhat, but I probably would have restored some hero worship if he'd at least had the guts to come forward on the cameras and admit and say, you know, gosh, I'm ashamed of what I did. He's MVP. He'll probably do it again. And all these young fans, not just in Milwaukee, but...
So, Luke, could I ask a question? Is he too far gone for you?
Well, that's a good question, Gene. Well, you want to be given a chance yourself, but in a certain context, yeah. I mean... If he just would have really come on the cameras and said, look, I'm here in person, first person, this press release stuff, that just, come on.
All right.
That reminds me of the San Diego thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Luke, for those comments.
All right. We move next to Nick in Milwaukee. Hey, Nick.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm okay with Ryan Braun's apology. I think baseball is a game, and there's a lot of pressure on all the players, and I believe it's a lot more than the guys that got caught in this recent scandal that are doing it. So as the former caller said, I think you either have to make it completely one strike and you're out, or this sort of in-the-middle ground just leads its way for everybody to be using it and hoping not to get caught with the millions of dollars at stake.
So you live in Milwaukee. Are you willing to go back to the ballpark and root for Ryan Braun when he's back?
Oh, yeah. If he performs up to the contract that he's getting paid. I think he brought winning baseball back to Milwaukee after a number of years, and as a fan, I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Nick. And Gene, what's our tally?
Final tally, I got to tell you, I'm going to be upfront about this. My math skills are somewhat weak, but it looks like 3 no's and 1 yes, and we've got banned for life. His apology wasn't strong enough, and so he doesn't look very good for Ryan, at least by our informal poll. So
well, we'll have to see how that develops over the coming months.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody, for calling in. You can continue to share thoughts, of course, about the Ryan Braun apology on our Facebook page.
Coming up, language is more than just grammar. It can also be wicked fun. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. Coming up at 8 o'clock Monday morning on Joy Cardine's show, Joy's guest has researched the many ways we're tinkering with animals these days and joins to discuss not just what we're doing and why, but the ethical questions that they raise. That's coming up at 8 o'clock on Joy Cardine Monday morning.
And right now we're going to be talking about writing a little bit. You know, in today's competitive economy, employers are looking for people who've got the complete package, and that package includes the ability to write and write well. Our next guest is here to help.
Constance Hale is here to teach us how to punch up our writing and help it stand out in a crowded marketplace. She's a journalist and the author of Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. Connie, welcome.
Thank you, Veronica.
So tell me, what does good writing need to look like today?
Ooh, hard question to answer, but let's start with concise, terse, but also powerful, punchy, interesting, colorful.
Those are all punchy and colorful words. So do we need to stick to the rules of good grammar to get there, do you think?
Well, yes and no. I actually think that it's less important to stick to the rules of good grammar than to stick to the rules of good writing. And some people call me a precision Nazi because what I focus on and what I really try to introduce in this book and sort of encourage writers to do is to constantly search for that perfect word. You know, so many times we fret over how I said it, have I said it fully, are my sentences too short, are my sentences too long, is the grammar right or wrong? And what we really should be focusing on is picking words that somehow speak to our readers and that are engaging and maybe create visual images. Most people, when they write, worry so much about grammar and red pens that they forget to fall in love all over again with words.
So you say that most poor people worry about those red pens and the grammar and so forth. Given the state of email today, given the state of everything, you know, how do you rate the average person's ability to write, you know, to write well?
Well, most people don't write particularly well. That's what keeps me in business as a writer, because I think if you can write well, that's a great calling card. But it's also just if you work at it, you get better. And so the main message of my book is that it's not that hard to write better than you do now. It requires a little bit of work, a few pointers. And, you know, the main problem with email or text is that people just send them off really quickly. They don't think very carefully about what they're saying. They don't try to deepen their meaning. But I'm not anti-email or anti-text. I think it's great that a lot of people, we're writing more than we used to, and I don't see that as a bad thing, particularly when sometimes text and email sounds more natural than the formal writing of English papers that get us an A from an English teacher. So that's the sin and syntax part of the equation. I'm constantly trying to balance the need to communicate and the need to communicate in a way that's deep and interesting with the desire to be true to ourselves and have an honest voice.
So here's a question, though. How do you know when you're not a very good writer? You know, if you need an exercise book and you're out of shape, you know that. But once you're out of school and those red pens stop and nobody's correcting your emails, or if you're the boss and nobody's got the guts to talk to you, how do you know when you're not really quite where you need to be?
Well, first of all, the easiest answer to that question is that all of us could get better. It's, you know, writing well is, in my mind, a lifelong project. So I think all of us, if we care about communicating well and we want to write better, you know, should keep working at it. And it takes a little bit of work. But the other thing is, are people reading what you write? I mean, that's the best judge of whether or not you're writing effectively. Do people email you after they've seen a Facebook post and say, or, you know, comment on your Facebook post and say, I just love the way you put that, or respond to it? If people respond to your writing, you're getting through to your audience. If they don't, that's a pretty good sign that you're doing something wrong.
And Connie, you talk about grammar as being sort of the bones of the writing, the thing that everything else hangs off of. What are some common grammatical missteps that we should clean up in our writing?
Well, I think probably the biggest grammatical misstep is failing to use a dynamic verb. And that wouldn't necessarily mean that your sentence is grammatically incorrect. So, for example, if I said, I am happy, there's nothing wrong with that sentence. It's just boring. And sometimes thinking one more moment about what I'm trying to say, I might say, those roses in the garden make my day. Maybe that's why I'm happy. So it's really a matter of recognizing when the prose is just boring, or you've chosen a boring verb and you're just missing the opportunity to say something. But there are some other common, one of the biggest mistakes I see all the time, because I'm an editor as well as a writer, is redundancy. People are redundant a lot. I think I was just redundant myself.
Happens to the best of us. So that makes for boring writing.
And of course, there are things like it's and it. There's kind of like all these little pet peeves that drive me crazy. And I think the difference between IT apostrophe S and ITS seems to be something that slays most writers out there. So I'd say redundancy, getting your it's and it's wrong, and just messing up pronouns generally sometimes.
You know, and another thing that I've noticed, and you sort of referred to it there in the redundancy comment, but a lot of people who write seem to think that quantity is more important than quality, and I'm wondering if you could speak to that, because, you know, you get an email or a paper that is pages and pages long, and you're looking for the substance in it there someplace.
Right. You know, there's a famous quote or clip by Blaise Pascal who said, I intended to write you a short letter, but lacking time, I wrote you a long one. I think that says something really important about writing, which is it actually takes a little bit of time and thought to write a short, concise, and powerful message, no matter whether it's a text or an email or a letter. So there's that we just don't think hard enough. But, you know, the idea of distilling something, there are some culprits in most sentences. Some of the culprits are things like prepositional phrases, and I don't mean to get grammatically geeky here, but prepositional phrases tend to bog down sentences a lot. Another huge culprit is using big words that sound important but are actually just pompous or maybe abstract. And so a lot of times when I'm working with writers, I'm trying to get them to be more specific. And going back to this idea of my being a precision Nazi, being more specific, more concrete, and more precise in each of the words you pick.
What's wrong with big words?
Say more with less.
What's wrong with big words? I like big words.
Give me a big word that you like.
Well, Gene and I argued about one today.
Ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous, which is actually...
That's a great word.
We both use it, but...
it's everywhere.
You know, ubiquitous is fine because how do you replace ubiquitous? Okay, it's everywhere, but, you know, ubiquitous is okay. Most people know what it means. But something like utilization, I'm sorry, that should just be use. You know, there are habits that we have of elongating words and or choosing a word like remunerate, because it makes us sound smart, when actually pay is fine.
Yeah, you make a good case.
Those are the habits. It's almost a way of thinking about words, recognizing that you're using a long Latinate polysyllabic word and then just asking yourself, is that really the most precise way to say it and the punchiest way of saying it? Or is there something a lot more grounded in a way?
So why do people do that then? Why is that so common? Are people not confident in their message and they think that pumping it up will make it more substantial? Or are they just trying to, I don't know, be unclear?
Aha, both, I think. But I. Oh, there you go. But let's assume that people aren't sort of trying to be unclear. Let's assume that people have their best intentions. I think part of the problem is the way we're taught to write. We generally are taught to write in English class. We're writing literary criticism or something like that. We're not writing an article about what happened at city council last night. So we're writing these abstract, from the beginning it's kind of an abstract thing we're writing about. Frequently English teachers reward big vocabulary. I don't know why they do that. It just happens. And then we're told to write long papers, and so we learn to pad. So we learn to use big words because they get us good grades, and we learn to pad our writing because that's the only way to get to 8 pages sometimes.
And we're going to have to leave it there for now. We'll come back and keep talking with Connie Hale about her book Sin and Syntax, about how to write effectively, how to make your writing stand out. And you can call us up with your questions, your grammatical pet peeves, and anything else on your mind about grammar and writing at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on our Facebook page.
Later this hour, we'll hear about the top state news stories with WPR's Noah Ovshinsky. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell with Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on WPR.
We're picking up our conversation with Connie Hale now about the rules of good grammar and how to make your writing stand out for the right reasons. You can talk to Connie about your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to the phones now. We've got John on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. I was listening in. I jumped in the car, and I caught the latter end of the conversation about how we're unnecessarily using big words in our vocabulary and how, you know, how it's just not necessary. And I just wanted to say I completely disagree. You know, I was fortunate enough to go to a private parochial school most of my life, and, you know, there was an emphasis on grammar, even at a young age, just speaking properly. And one of the things I wanted to say is we live in an age where everything is so digital, so instant. We want things quicker, faster, right now. And so we're using LOL and BTW and BRB. And, I just think that while we're using those in our daily lives, I think it's still important to have an emphasis on teaching kids and students and everybody to, you know, learn to express themselves a little bit differently and articulate their thoughts through, you know, different words, not necessarily bigger words, but, you know, I just didn't buy that argument, really.
All right. Thanks a lot, John. What do you think, Connie? Since we're in prone to abbreviating right now, thanks to our digital lives, is language falling by the wayside?
You know, well, I agree with John, actually, absolutely. As I said earlier, it's not whether a word is big or small, it's whether it's better, whether it's a great word for what you're trying to express. So I use the thesaurus in the dictionary every day when I write. And so that's really the point that I'm trying to make is the quality of the word and how closely we can get to expressing feelings or thoughts with some nuance. I'm not terribly worried about the abbreviations that we use in texting and email because I think we've always had certain, if you go back to the days of the telegraph, there were a lot of abbreviations at that time too. And I think the most important thing for us as writers to do is distinguish when we're sending a text and when we just really are trying to be brief and when we're trying to write something maybe more formal or maybe just more meaningful. And that's when it pays to take the time to consider all the words. And to pick up on John's point, not just long words, but words that have beautiful beauty or sonority. I care a lot about the way words sound in conjunction with each other and the way sentences sound. So I think attuning to the music of language is important as well.
So do you sort of sound things out to yourself as you write them to see how
Absolutely.
They're actually going to, you do that, huh?
Absolutely, I do. And you know what I do when I'm teaching writing? I think it's not enough just to read your own work out loud. It's really helpful to have someone else read your work out loud because that someone else doesn't know how you meant it to sound. And sometimes the best way of hearing infelicities in your own prose, infelicities to use a long word, is to have someone else read it. You hear where they trip or you hear where they don't know how to pronounce something, and that's a pretty good clue as to what you need to go
back. That takes guts, though, I got to tell you. Let's go to the phones right now, and Chris joins us from Sparta. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was just calling to talk a little bit about my grammar teacher in high school. Kind of gave me a pet peeve, and every time we used a preposition at the end of a sentence, she would slap her hand on the table, and if you had said, "Where's it at?" she would just scream, at. So ever since then, developed a pet peeve with that. And she had a couple other things, too, like making sure that we knew that children were reared and bred is raised, and kids are actually goats. And the little things like that that are fun trivia.
She sounds like a stickler. I don't know. She's very exacting. What do you think about that kind of language sticklerdom, Connie?
Well, anyone who makes people attuned to language, as she clearly did with Chris, it gets points in my book. The problem with grammar is that a lot of the rules that have been passed down for centuries actually don't comport with English. So there are a lot of false rules or rules that maybe grammar teachers insist on, but that actually do nothing to help make your writing better. So those are some, that's what the title Sin and Syntax tries to get at, this paradox where there are some rules that are really important for us to pay attention to if our point is to write better. Some of the rules really are, I don't want to say worthless, but they're not a big help if what you're trying to do is write better. And you'll see many writers from Shakespeare to Muhammad Ali to Barack Obama break those rules.
And sometimes that's the best part.
That's the sin part of the sin and sin equation.
Well, we've talked a lot about some of the things, the pet peeves with our callers, but tell us a little bit about the cardinal do's of writing. What are they?
Well, my book, in each chapter, there's a section called the cardinal sins, and those are obviously the don'ts, the things you shouldn't do. And then there's a section called carnal pleasures. And that is a time where I show really brilliant writers breaking the rules brilliantly. So it may be a case of someone not writing in standard English, but writing in non-standard English. It might be a case of someone ending a sentence with a preposition. That's never going to make the great American novel, but there are a lot of instances in which it's completely correct to end a sentence with a preposition. I can get into the grammar weeds on that, but I'll spare you right now. So the idea is that really the reason to learn the rules and to go on this exploration of English and English grammar is so that when you as a writer are trying to be colorful or powerful in your own prose, you know when to break the rules. It can be fight humor a lot of times depends on breaking the rules.
Yeah, I've got to know when to do it. That's always the trick.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the phone. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking of Groucho Marx, where he says, "I just shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got into my pajamas, I'll never know." Well, what? That was a dangling modifier. Did he know it was called a dangling modifier? Probably not, but he knew it was funny.
He did indeed. Oh, boy. Let's go to the phones. Colin is with us from Madison. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I study linguistics at the university, and I was told that there were a bunch of these rules that were made up a long time ago, as you said, that don't do anything for English, but were to make English a little bit more like Latin, which was a prestigious language, such as not leaving a preposition at the end of a word when you move the phrase up to the front, and not splitting the infinitive, because in Latin it's just impossible to do those things because of the structure of the language. And I was wondering if you could tell me if that was really the reason why those rules came about, or what? Because I can know for one thing that they're certainly not part of the cognitive aspect of language as we perceive it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that question, Colin. And I actually have spent more time than anyone should with linguistics books and books on the history of English, because I was really once I figured out that some of these rules didn't make any sense, I was dying of curiosity to find out where they came from. And in fact, the history of some of these rules is that 400 years ago in the 1600s, 1700s, if you think of the 1600s, Elizabethan England, it was a time of an incredible flowering of our language and a lot of invention, a lot of creativity, but there were no rules. People spelled things this way and that way. There wasn't grammar studied in the way that we know it now. And there were a number of mostly priests and clerks who felt that English should be less of a messy language. And they did indeed look to Latin for grammar, because Latin had this, you know, famous grammar, and they brought the rules of Latin grammar into English. The problem is English is not a Latin language. It's a Germanic language. And so what you had was rules from one kind of language imported and imposed on another kind of language. Bill Bryson says it's like, I forget them. He has a sports metaphor. It's like teaching baseball rules to people on a football field.
And Bill Bryson is somebody who can write an awful lot in a pretty few short words. You know, as your book winds up in the epilogue, as I was reading it, I was reminded of that old saying that writers write. And at the very end of the book, I think the last two words in your book are stop reading.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, get out there and get to it.
Mm-hmm. So much of what we really need to learn is what we learn by trial and error in our own writing. What works, what doesn't work, what sentence makes us feel pleased, what touches other people, and really the only way to figure that out is to start doing it.
Well, Connie, it's been fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dean and Veronica. Great to talk with you.
That was journalist Constance Hale. She's the author of Sin and Syntax.
And coming up, we check the latest headlines and then find out what's making news in Wisconsin this week with WPR's Noah Ovshinsky. This is Central Time on WPR.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin Public Radio's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky, is here now to look back at the top news stories in Wisconsin this week. Hey, Noah. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon. Top-ish, I have to say. It's been kind of a slow news week here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, there has been some speed out there. I see you're
nice
get where I'm
transition.
Going with this, right?
Very
and,
nice.
And the highways, it's weekend. Weekend, people will be driving around, and if one lawmaker gets his way, they'll be driving faster.
They will be. And in fact, that's sort of the big news and legislative news this week. Manitowoc Assembly Republican Paul Tittle unveiled legislation earlier this week that increases the speed limit here in Wisconsin on interstates to 70 miles per hour.
So it's 5 miles difference. Where is this coming from?
Call it a coincidence. Maybe not. Who's to say? But this bill was introduced a day after Illinois' governor signed a law to raise that state's speed limit to 70 miles per hour. But basically, Tittle has said that, you know, now's the time to do it. He actually sort of talked about the scenario where he was driving, and he as a test for himself, he decided to drive at 65 miles per hour, which is the current speed limit, to see what happens. And basically, he said, well, as we might all expect, everybody was passing him and passing him quite quickly. And he said, you know, this is ridiculous, you know, and you know, people should be able to get where they need to get quicker, especially given that Illinois and every other Wisconsin neighbor actually has, a speed limit of 70 miles per hour. So he's introducing this legislation to do just that.
Any idea what opponents are saying?
Well, let's start here in Wisconsin, then we can sort of move our way outward from there. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who, of course, is a very influential person in the state capitol, says he supports the measure, which is good. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, however, again, another very influential voice, says there are currently no plans to tackle the proposal anytime soon. So that's a potential roadblock. And Walker's office, Governor Walker's office, did say the governor will evaluate the bill when it gets to his desk. So it wasn't really a big endorsement, but he said he'll consider it when it gets to his desk. As far as critics are concerned, the automobile insurance companies are, surprise, surprise, quite against this kind of increase in speed limits.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit on the show, and callers, some of them, Facebook participants, worried that it's going to lead to less safety on the roads. So there's that out there. There's some things to get through, but it's not completely out there. How many other states are doing this already?
Yeah, I believe at last count there were 37 states that have approved speed limits of 70 miles per hour. Some states actually have faster speed limits than that. And this was all made possible back in the mid-90s when the national speed limit, which we had at one point, was repealed.
Okay. Well, that's when we'll be watching. Doesn't sound like it's moving quickly through the through the legislature, so we'll be watching that one. And to move on to another couple of stories that have been making news here in Wisconsin. This is a topic that's so often on the top of people's minds, frac sand.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue, and it's one that we did see some news being made this week. Two things, actually, in particular. Last night, an organization that probably most folks haven't heard of, but kind of influential in their own area, the Lower Wisconsin State Riverway Board, which is this group of folks who are essentially are in charge of ensuring the scenic beauty of a certain part of the Wisconsin River. It's like 80,000 acres. I think it's something like 90 plus miles of the Wisconsin River. This board is in charge of ensuring its beauty. And they had a board meeting earlier this week where they dealt with a frac sand mining company that wanted to mine right next to the river.
And what happened then? What did they say?
They voted 6-2 to not allow them or not to issue the permit that would allow the frac sand company to mine next to the river. You know, they basically argued that, you know, it will take away from the beauty. And of course, there were a lot of residents and environmentalists who were against the idea of having a frac sand mine so close to the river. And so they voted to stop it. Now, that being said, the company, it's sort of a large piece of property. It's something like 300 acres. And there are 240 of those acres that aren't near the river, which they will, in all likelihood, you know, mine. But there's the 60 acres right next to the river that now, according to this board, they are not allowed to mine.
I suppose it's hard for a frac sand company to argue that mining there will increase the beauty of the area. But so how did they argue against that?
Right. So the mine argued that people wouldn't be able to see the mine from the river when there are leaves on the trees. The board said basically that the company can't prove that people can't see it. And the board went on, at least those members of the board who supported, you know, restricting the mining there. They argue that, you know, if we approve this, then it's a slippery slope, you know. You know what? If they approve it, this mine, then you know every other mine that comes to them, who's going to want to site a mine next to the river, that they're going to do it, and it's going to take away from the beauty overall of the river.
Frac sand mining has been contentious in lots of areas of Wisconsin lately. How big a deal is this particular move?
I think it is. I think it is pretty big in the sense that here is an organization who has some authority to do this. Say, look. The Wisconsin River is off limits, you know, for frac sand mining right next to it, you know. So for those people who enjoy the river, who live on the river, who recreate on the river, you know, I think it's a big deal because it means at least within this area of the river, frac sand mining isn't going to happen. And I think for many of those folks, that's a big deal.
So it's like drawing a line of sorts.
Yeah, it is. And it is. And as the people who on the board who voted to stop the mine from doing this, as they said, it's, you know, basically we're doing this to prevent not only this mine, but any future mine from being established right next to the river.
Well, and speaking of drawing of lines, Trempealeau County did some line drawing themselves. It sounds like they passed a one-year moratorium.
Yeah, Trempealeau County is an interesting case. As you mentioned, they did pass a moratorium at a meeting early this week. And they're an interesting case because here's a county that is chock full of frac sand companies. I think there are 26 frac sand mines and processing centers in the county, and that's a lot. That's a lot. 11 are already operational and 15 more are in development. So frac sand mining is really part and parcel of this county right now. Even so, they've now decided, oh, let's take a year here to think about this, because there are those on the county board who want to study the health and environmental impact of the industry in this county.
And that's a pretty big undertaking for a county, because frac sand mining, this is a national health issue that people are still trying to wrap their minds around. What is the opposition to a county taking this on?
Yeah, there were folks on the board and other officials who were a little ambivalent about this whole idea of a moratorium, especially because they're doing it in order to study the health effects. They're like, look, we're a small county. You know, we don't have the money. We're not equipped to take on this kind of health study that's going to look at frac sand mining, and that they're going to have to rely on, you know, agencies like the EPA, the feds, who have already studied this stuff and found it to be safe. And so it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out over the course of the next year. Again, especially in a county that has a lot of frac sand mining right now.
And so what happens with the frac sand mining mining sites that already have permits?
Yeah, this does not affect them, other than if any of these mines want to expand, those expansion plans, if they come up with those expansion plans in the next year, that won't be allowed. But if they are already existing, it's good to go.
So do you have a sense of how big the frac sand industry is in Wisconsin right now, since it comes up over and over?
It's big, and it's getting bigger. You know, Minnesota has basically taken a sort of wait and see approach to the industry. They've got a moratorium in effect there. Here in Wisconsin, state government has taken a much more hands off approach to the industry. They're relying more on cities, townships, counties to regulate the industry. And so what we have is sort of this patchwork of regulation around the state. And so you find one county doing this, another county doing that. And it's very interesting to see how they're all choosing to regulate and oversee this increasingly large industry here in the state.
Is there any kind of consensus emerging that you
no,
can see
I,
so far?
It all depends on who you are. I mean, if you're in a community and you're jobless and there are employment opportunities with these mines, I'm sure it's potentially a good thing for you because you're looking for a job. For environmentalists, they look at it as an environmental issue and one that's most likely bad for the environment. And if you're a politician, you're just trying to keep up, you know, because, again, a lot of these counties are really small and these are really big companies coming in trying to get permits for these mines. And so they're just trying to keep up with the permitting that goes along with all of this.
Well, let's move on to the last story we're going to talk about today. And this is kind of a bittersweet one. So trees the leaves are falling already. What's with that?
Yeah, this was something that came across my desk. Actually, Rich Kramer, the reporter here at WPR, was driving and he saw that leaves up by him in the sort of Chippewa Valley, Eau Claire area were already turning and dropping. And it's like late August. It's really early.
I noticed that too. I was dismayed.
And of course, any good journalist, he's like, ooh, maybe there's a story here. And in fact, there is. And the reality is these trees are under a lot of stress right now here in Wisconsin. And that's largely because of course, we have to go back in time. The drought last summer put these trees really under a lot of stress. And that's even playing out this summer. And so it's made these trees much more, disease, bugs, all the things that trees hate. Of course, the lack of water. We had a pretty wet spring.
Yeah, very wet spring. You'd think that would have set things right.
Except we've had a pretty dry summer since then. You know, we've had a dry few months. And so what it means is these trees are under a lot of stress. And in fact, we've seen some pretty significant die-offs with particular kinds of trees, pines, spruce, tamarack. These are all trees that are really sensitive to this kind of stress.
Is this going to mess up our beautiful fall colors?
I don't think so. But
I hold you personally responsible for this answer.
Yeah, and don't hold me to that. I think we'll still have some beautiful color in the state, but I think it is concerning that the trees, we thought we were out of the woods with the drought last summer, and in fact, we're not.
All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping by, Noah.
Thanks. It was good to be here.
That was Noah Ofshinsky, Assistant News Director here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, the soda industry could be in trouble. We'll talk about what the trends look like for the industry and how they're trying to deal with them. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.